From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The AIDS epidemic has presented society a basic dilemma: how to best balance public safety and the civil liberties of the individual. Ronald Baer examines such ethical issues in his new book, Private Acts, Social Consequences. We look at AIDS and public health policy on this edition of Fresh Air. Also today, we meet mystery writer Seymour Shubin. His new novel is inspired by the police photos of a child's corpse that were circulated back when he wrote for True Detective magazine. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new reissue of Hoagy Carmichael singing his own songs. And television critic David Bianculli takes a second look at Tattingers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The AIDS epidemic has forced us to confront difficult ethical questions. How do we best protect the public against further spread of the disease while still protecting the civil liberties of those who have AIDS? Mandatory testing, quarantining, and the confidentiality of medical records have been the subjects of ongoing debates between public health officials, politicians, gay leaders, civil rights leaders, and advocates of civil liberties. My guest Ronald Baer co-chaired the first national project to study the ethical and social challenges posed by AIDS. The committee was formed in 1983 at the Hastings Center, a nonprofit national research organization that studies ethical issues in medicine and the life sciences. Now Baer is continuing his involvement with the public policy debate as an associate professor at the Columbia University School of Public Health. And he has written a new book on AIDS and the politics of public health called Private Acts, Social Consequences. Ronald Baer got involved in the public health debate on AIDS at the start of the crisis.
Many years ago, it seems now, early on in the epidemic, a researcher, one of the first researchers to be dealing with AIDS, Matilda Krim, who's since emerged as a major national figure, in dealing with the problems of AIDS, came to me at the Hastings Center and said, you know, Ron, there is a very critical issue that's beginning to emerge in the United States. There's this new disease. No one knows anything about it. It touches on the most intimate details of people's lives, their sex lives. Largely gay men are involved, some IV drug users, some Haitians. We can't get people to cooperate with our studies because they're afraid of the possibility of the violation of confidentiality. Can you help draft some recommendations that would protect the confidentiality of individuals who were going to be research subjects? And I said, sure, and we brought together a group of scientists, public health people, ethicists, philosophers, historians, and drafted those recommendations. But the thing that struck me, even at that very, very early date, is that suddenly we were confronted with a potentially catastrophic impact on the public health that was taking place in the context of the most intimate relationships. And so this tension between intimacy on the one hand and severe public health challenge on the other struck me as having significance far beyond the issue of AIDS itself, although AIDS was plenty serious, but went to the core of what it is to live in a liberal society.
Do you think that AIDS has presented us with new ethical dilemmas?
I think it's confronted us with old dilemmas in new guises. You know, one of the things that's sort of interesting about AIDS and very critical is that Americans have not had to deal with an infectious disease, with an epidemic, for more than two decades. I mean, I think the last major infectious disease was polio. And really, before polio, we had really come to the end of the era of epidemics, of infectious diseases. And so suddenly, AIDS confronted us with all of the old ethical questions about the relationship between individual and society, privacy, confidentiality, informed consent, but in the context of a major new kind of threat, really an old kind of threat to society, but one with which we had very little experience. And I think most ethicists, for instance, had no way of thinking about the ethics of public health. And that really became my challenge, to think about the ethics of public health. They had only thought about the ethics of the clinical encounter. What does a doctor do with one patient, or what does a doctor do with elderly patients, for instance? But rarely had people involved in medical ethics had to think about the broad social issue of public health.
I think the people involved with medical ethics, too, were faced with something unusual, and that is that the first group that was stricken in large numbers was homosexuals.
Right.
And there was a lot of fear about the social rights of people who are infected because there's so much homophobia in our society.
I mean, it's clear that one of the things that marked this epidemic from the beginning was the fact that it was the most vulnerable in our society who were struck first. I think that always in the context of an epidemic, those who are seen as carriers, those who are seen as a potential threat to the public health become vulnerable. But this was a vulnerability which was amplified by the fact that it was gay men and intravenous drug users. And the intravenous drug users, of course, were largely, though not exclusively, black and Hispanic. The sexual partners of IV drug users, who were largely poor black and Hispanic women. So that here we had a kind of a major challenge to public health with all of the social anxieties that always accompany that kind of challenge. And then those groups that were most affected were those who were vulnerable to discrimination, exploitation. But what made this somewhat different, and what made all of the debates around AIDS somewhat different, is that at least in the case of gay men, there was a capacity to articulate forcefully a set of interests around privacy and the protection of confidentiality. If you would think for imagine what the discussion around AIDS would have looked like had all of those first struck been black and Hispanic IV drug users or poor black and Hispanic women in the ghettos, I think that many of the issues would have remained the same, but it's clear to me that there would have been no forceful voice, like the voice of the National Gay Task Force, for instance, the Lambda Legal Defense Fund, all of which were capable of articulating a set of interests that really forced public health officials to recognize that in the context of this epidemic, that it was going to be necessary to develop a negotiating relationship, a political relationship, with those most at risk.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Ronald Bayer. He's the author of Private Acts, Social Consequences, AIDS and the Politics of Public Health. Maybe we can take some time to look at some of the specific issues that you've been analyzing and see what kinds of conclusions you've reached.
Sure.
I think one of the controversies that has been with us right from the start is the issue of mandatory screening.
Mm-hmm.
What function does mandatory screening usually play when it has been used in the past for a disease?
Well, when mandatory screening has played some important role, for instance, in the effort to control tuberculosis, there generally was a desire to identify those who carried an infectious agent so that a specific therapeutic intervention could take place to render that person safe to the public. So that you would make sure everyone took a TB test, and if you found someone who's infectious, who by their mere presence in public posed a hazard, then you would give them the appropriate medication and make sure that they couldn't spread the disease to others. And I think people have that image in mind of the old era of large-scale mandatory testing, where there was something that public health officials could do to protect the public health as a result of identifying the infected when they think about AIDS. But AIDS is, of course, very different. In the first place, AIDS is not transmitted, as we know and as we've heard over and over again. AIDS is not transmitted merely by the presence of an individual in public. AIDS is spread, HIV infection, I should say, is spread as a result of specific acts. Furthermore, there's really very little that public health officials can do to prevent the spread of HIV infection, except in getting individuals to change their behavior. And that, of course, doesn't require mandatory testing. What it requires is forceful and aggressive education that gets people to recognize the threat to which they may be exposed and the threat that they might pose for others by their behavior. What mandatory testing could do in a situation like this is to create enormous amounts of social anxiety, fear, defensiveness, efforts to avoid coerced identification on the part of those most at risk. And it would simply be a placebo to those who feel that a tough epidemic, a rough situation requires tough measures, sort of a Rambo version of public health. It won't work.
There's at least two states that adopted mandatory premarital testing for the HIV virus. Louisiana and Illinois are the states you mentioned in your book. How did their programs for mandatory premarital testing work out?
Well, they both failed. Many people, those of us who are over 40 and who are married, may remember that it was quite traditional for people to get a premarital syphilis test in the United States. Because those were policies that developed in the 1940s as a way of guaranteeing that, or trying to assure that when married couples tied their marriage vows, that generally the man who might have had an active sexual life wouldn't infect his assumedly virgin wife. Well, what we learned as a result of these very elaborate premarital screening tests is that they weren't working very well, that the people who were getting married very rarely had VD, and the people who were getting married had already had sexual relations before they got married. And so in state after state, there were efforts to eliminate premarital VD screening laws. I think half the states in the country, as a matter of fact, had eliminated them before the advent of AIDS. Then comes AIDS. People said, why not do what we've always done with VD? Well, the answer from public health officials was, we're doing precisely with AIDS what we've done with VD. We're eliminating premarital screening. Now, the move to enact mandatory screening laws in Louisiana and in Illinois, interestingly, came not from public health officials, who very strongly opposed them as unwarranted, as foolish, as a kind of placebo. They came from politicians, who said we have to take tough measures. The law in Louisiana was enacted, and within a year, the state legislature voted to overturn the law because it wasn't identifying anyone who's infected. In Illinois, the chief public health officer of that state has been opposed to the law for premarital screening from the beginning, continues to be opposed to it, and it's the legislature, really in a political move, that has opposed a rescission of that law, even though it has been very, very ineffective. And what's happening is that people in Illinois simply cross the border over to Wisconsin to get married without the premarital screening.
So you think that in many ways politicians have been opportunistic in their reaction to AIDS?
I think they have kind of concocted a kind of a layman's view of the history of public health and have tried to apply it to this very fearsome and fearful, I mean, and terrifying situation. By and large, though, I think that politicians have been very careful and thoughtful in the response to this epidemic, if slow. And I think they, by and large, one could say that the situation could have been a lot worse. I mean, there have been plenty of mistakes, and certainly the failure of the Reagan administration to allocate adequate resources early on in the epidemic for education, prevention, research needn't be underscored any more than it's already been underscored. It's been a national tragedy. On the other hand, given the nature of the populations first affected, gay men, IV drug users, given the fear in America, there could have been really a quite repressive turn in public policy. And that there hasn't, I think, is something that is worthy of note and suggests that America has met this epidemic, if slowly, with a certain degree of maturity. And now that the resources are coming forward, I think we have reason to believe that, for instance, the report of Admiral Watkins and the President's Commission on AIDS, all of which kind of have lent force to the idea that you're not going to solve this epidemic with repressive moves. That what we really have to strive for is mass behavioral change, and the kind of mass behavioral change that I think can only occur if the culture that surrounds behavior, sexual behavior, drug-using behavior, begins to change in a way that I describe in my book in terms of a culture of responsibility.
You recently returned from Cuba. You visited Cuba in October to see how they were responding right to the spread of AIDS. What were some of the measures that have been taken in Cuba?
Well, if one wanted to look at a situation which is the polar opposite of the way we, as well as most Western countries, have responded to AIDS, one would turn to Cuba. Cuba has decided to screen its entire population, mandatory screening. They've already screened a third of the population. And everyone who's infected with the AIDS virus, HIV, is placed into a sanatorium for life, deprived of the right to work, separated from their families unless their mates happen to be infected, separated from their children. And they believe that they will break the back of the epidemic in Cuba by the compulsory identification of the infected and by the incarceration of those who are infected. They are quite proud of what they've done. They believe that an island country with very few infected individuals at this point, they have an epidemiological opportunity they're not going to pass up. The irony, of course, I thought this while I was in Cuba, the irony, of course, is that the program adopted in Cuba is precisely the kind of program that in the United States is really most favored by people at the extreme right wing. I had this fantasy while I was in Cuba of Congressman Dannemeyer from California going down to Havana to shake hands with Fidel, applauding him for his tough and brave measures to confront the AIDS epidemic. I don't think what Cuba is doing has any bearing on what we could do in the United States. They may have, they've identified about 250, 260 individuals who are infected. They may identify another 500 who are infected. We have over a million people who are infected. They could isolate 250 people in a small sanatorium. They may have to build one other. We would have to build a virtual parallel prison system if we were going to do the same thing. And of course, Cuba is a very different political culture.
You've made it clear that you think that quarantining would be impractical in the United States because
right.
there are so many cases of AIDS. Do you think it would be effective if there was any way of making it happen?
Well, it depends what you mean by effective. I don't think it could happen in the United States again because we are not an island nation. We don't have the kinds of controls that the Cuban government has over its population, over exit and entry into the country. But I think there's another issue, and it brings me to the heart of what I'm primarily interested in. The question is, effective or successful at what price?
Mm-hmm.
What the Cubans really have done is preventive detention in the name of medicine. They are willing to incarcerate people because of what they might do in the future, because of the sexual conduct they might engage in the future. In the United States, the principles of our jurisprudence and our political system, in general, reject notions of preventive detention. People are punished or incarcerated because of what they've done in the past. So the idea that one would round up a million people who are infected with the AIDS virus and hold them in quarantine because of what they might do in the future would really tear at the essential nature of what it means to live in a liberal democracy. And I think that's why liberal societies in Western Europe, Northern Europe, and on this continent have rejected the Cuban model.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your analysis of the ethics
right.
Pertaining to the spread of AIDS. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Ronald Baer, and he's the author of the new book, Private Acts, Social Consequences, AIDS, and the Politics of Public Health. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest Ronald Baer co-chaired the first national project to study the ethical and social challenges posed by AIDS. This was at the Hastings Center. Baer is now studying these issues as an associate professor at the Columbia University School of Public Health. His new book is called Private Acts, Social Consequences. Let's look at the question of what is the social responsibility of a person who has AIDS?
Right.
And should there be any legal limits to their behavior?
Well, let me just correct you for a moment. We're
yeah.
really concerned not only with people who have AIDS, which is the end stage of a terrible infection, but people who are infected with a virus, some of whom may not even know that they're infected,
mm-hmm.
who carry this virus that can be transmitted to lovers, marital partners, and babies as well, if the woman were to become pregnant, drug-using partners. I think one of the things that I've struggled with in my book is the question of what is the responsibility of someone who's HIV infected to intimates as well as to society. And I come to the notion that individuals who are infected bear an enormous burden, an enormous responsibility to act in such ways that they don't put others at risk. That means in the context of sexual relationships, either heterosexual or homosexual, that if one is infected or thinks one might be infected, that one, has to insist on the use of condoms to try to prevent the spread of the infection sexually. And at the same time, because condoms are not absolutely perfect, there are condoms break, they slip. I think it's important to tell one's sexual partner, I am infected with this AIDS virus. You ought to know that so that you can make a decision about whether or not we're going to have a sexual relationship. It's much more difficult to ask the question, what ought to an infected woman do in terms of considering pregnancy? The risk of transmitting the virus from an infected woman to her fetus is about 20% to 50%. If every woman who were infected chose to run those risks, if a woman said, look, those risks don't sound so bad to me, there would be many, many thousands of babies born with HIV infection and who would go on to a quite grim and terrible death. So I think that women who are infected are really going to have to confront the question, how do I exercise my reproductive rights? How do I exercise my reproductive freedom? Maybe I shouldn't have a child because I don't want to bring a child into the world who is going to suffer.
If a person who knows that they have AIDS engages in sex with another person without notifying the other person that they have AIDS, should there be any legal consequences?
I think ultimately, yes. I mean, my first preference would be to... First of all, it's going to be very hard to identify who these people are since most of the acts are private, as I point out in my book. But I think if it comes to the attention of public health authorities that there is such an individual who knew himself or herself to be infected, who engaged in sexual activity without warning a partner, I think, first of all, it's important to recognize that person has committed an undeniably grave moral harm to the sexual partner. After all, sexual relations are relations of intimacy and trust. And this was not only a violation of trust, but a dangerous violation of trust. Ultimately, I think that if efforts to counsel a person, to get them to change the behavior, fails, then ultimately, and we don't know how many such cases there are, there may be very few, we can never tell, that ultimately such individuals should be subject to some kind of control. Whether that control should be in the form of punishment under the criminal law, or whether that person should be held under public health law, which operates under somewhat different juridical premises, that really has to be debated. But people have been very, very nervous about talking about this issue, that is, what to do with the individual who willfully infects another, because they're afraid that there'll be an easy slippage from talking about that case to the more generalized quarantine a la Cuba. I think it's just the other way around. I think if we're unwilling to talk about that hard case, if we're unwilling to talk about that individual, those few individuals who act in a malicious and dangerous way, that it will fuel general anxieties and will fuel, in fact, interest in more general quarantine. But there is a way to, I mean, it's. I don't want to avoid the question of what should be done. I think that individuals who willfully infect others ought to be controlled in some way until it can be shown that they will not continue that kind of behavior. But I think that the question is, why do people act that way? What motivates them to act that way? And how can we prevent it? And I think there we get to the core of my argument, and that is that what we really have to witness, and the real challenge of public health, is not to identify those few individuals who behave this way, but a real challenge to public health is to create the public climate within which a general change in the culture of sexual responsibility can take place. If we fail in that measure, we've lost this battle against AIDS.
Since AIDS is being spread by the use of needles by IV drug users, the issue has come up, should cities distribute free needles to drug users?
Right.
This raises the complicated issue of what should take precedence, the anti-drug campaign or the protection of people to whom AIDS might spread, you know, protecting people from the spread of AIDS. How do you handle that one?
Well, I argue in the book that the experiments with needle exchange should have been undertaken a long time ago. It's laudable that Steve Joseph in New York City has undertaken such an experiment, although it was the effort to win the permission to undertake that experiment was a brutalizing one, I think, and has made the experiment very small, unnecessarily small. There's no question that stopping the transmission of HIV infection must take priority in our struggle against AIDS and in our struggle against intravenous drug use. It not only has to take priority because we're talking about death, but because the transmission of the virus from IV drug users to their sexual partners is the route of heterosexual transmission in the United States and ultimately the route of transmission to infants. In most cases, public health officials have been much more willing to consider the option of needle exchange than have politicians who've been extremely nervous about it. And I understand why. We, on the one hand, say we're interested in a campaign against drug addiction, although it is remarkable that 7.5 years into this epidemic, there are still waiting lists for people who want to get into drug abuse treatment who can't because there are no positions for them, no openings for them. That, to me, is a scandal of enormous proportions. And one should ask if there are people out there who are so concerned about drug abuse that they would oppose needle exchanges, where were they during all the first years of the epidemic when they should have been screaming to open up drug abuse treatment programs, and they didn't?
Let me ask you about the insurance question. Sure. I know some people who are diagnosed as having AIDS end up losing their job and end up losing their insurance. Or if they keep their job, I know of at least one case where their insurance was suddenly changed on them so that they had a very low ceiling.
Right.
And so that the insurance company would only pay for a very minimal amount of medical bills per year, knowing that the AIDS bills would be far higher, that just the medication would be far higher than the allowance by the insurance company. What do you think the ethical responsibility is of the society to see to it that people with AIDS can take care of themselves medically?
The problem you raise really is a uniquely American problem, because the United States is the only advanced industrial society, the only advanced industrial democracy that doesn't guarantee to all of its citizens access to health care regardless of their ability to pay. There, of course, would be an easy way to answer your question. I don't think it's going to be the immediate way to answer your question. That is, America should guarantee everyone, whether they have HIV infection, whether they have hypertension, whether they have ulcers, everyone has a right to access to health care. And the government, whether it be the state or federal government, ought to guarantee such access so that people aren't afraid of losing their health insurance and therefore their ability to gain access to appropriate medical treatment. But certainly, the problem is that we have a health insurance scheme in the United States that is employment-based. Employers have an interest not in hiring people who may increase the cost of their premiums. And individuals, of course, have an interest in hiding that fact from their employers and from insurance companies, because they desperately recognize that if they were to become sick, their medical care is going to be very, very expensive. Maybe one of the benefits of this tragic epidemic is that we will come to recognize the need to transform that healthcare system so that we don't have to face situations like this again.
Do you see any short-term solutions?
I think states have to pass laws that prohibit the use of antibody testing by health insurance companies.
You end your book by saying that you think a posture of stoicism is needed,
right.
And I'd like you to explain that.
Sure. I think we're in for a very hard time in the next few years. The number of AIDS cases is going to mount very dramatically. Even if we could stop the spread of this virus tomorrow, which we can't, the number of cases already coming down the pipeline because of infection will skyrocket. In the next 3 years, it'll be 190,000 new cases of AIDS. It took us 7.5 years to get the first 80,000. That's going to create enormous amounts of pressures, I think, for rash repressive measures. Stoicism, that is recognizing the difficult situation we confront and facing it directly and boldly, I would say, is necessary to confront the threat that there will be a kind of rash turn to repression. On the other hand, I think sometimes when things get very bad, there's a tendency to believe a kind of wish fulfillment that things will get better tomorrow, that a vaccine will be discovered tomorrow, that we needn't worry, that things will be fine. I think we have to avoid that kind of false optimism. What we need is a kind of courage. And I think Stoicism provides you with that kind of courage, a courage to face a very serious, dreadful situation, the courage to demand that resources be made available, the courage to face hard ethical and social issues without recourse to inappropriate models of repression or inappropriate visions of what public health taught us from the early part of the century, and hope that with the commitment of resources over the next decade, that we will find therapeutic interventions which can work even if a vaccine remains elusive.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Thanks.
My guest has been Ronald Bayer, and his new book, Private Acts, Social Consequences, AIDS and the Politics of Public Health, is published by the Free Press. Bayer is an associate professor at the Columbia University School of Public Health. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Back when Seymour Shubin wrote for True Detective magazine, the police circulated photos of a child's corpse dressed in clothes and propped up on a chair. The photos were supposed to help identify the body, but no one ever did. Those haunting photos are the basis of Shubin's new mystery. He tells us about it on today's Fresh Air. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Hoagy Sings Carmichael. It's a new reissue of one of America's great songwriters doing his own songs. And television critic David Bianculli says if you've become a fan of the NBC series Tattingers, you're in for a surprise. The network has some changes planned. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. President Reagan today sent Congress his last budget. It calls for spending of $1.15 trillion, leaving a deficit of a little over $98 billion. That's just under the $100 billion required by the Graham-Rudman-Hollings legislation. More from NPR's Jim Angle.
The last round of Reagan budget cuts calls for the elimination of 82 federal programs, including Amtrak, legal services for the poor, and a number of grants to the states for sewage treatment plants and mass transit. Medicare funding will get a smaller increase than planned, a result of paying less to health care providers, and the states, which administer Medicaid, will get about half what they were expecting. The Reagan plan would reduce many other programs, including cuts in farm subsidies, by $2 billion a year. But defense spending would increase by 2% after inflation. The budget would increase a number of other programs, including AIDS research, space programs, the war on drugs, environmental cleanups, and air safety. President Reagan said today this budget proves no new taxes are needed to balance the budget by 1993. He said economic growth will bring in $84 billion in 1990 alone.
Thanks to our record expansion, the money is literally rolling in. Those who want to tax away even more hard-earned dollars from working people ought to be ashamed of themselves.
Congress is now waiting to see how much of the Reagan budget is adopted by President-elect Bush. I'm Jim Angle in Washington.
Included in the budget is a big increase in funding for cleaning up environmental hazards created by the nation's nuclear weapons plants. More from Michael Richards.
The Energy Department budget calls for an increase in excess of 50% for cleanup and toxic waste disposal at nuclear weapons plants. Nuclear weapons facilities have been at the center of a controversy because a number of sites have leaked, contaminating local areas with both radiation and toxic chemicals. Deputy Energy Secretary John Salzado says the proposed Energy Department budget will begin the cleanup process, a process experts say will take decades. But Ohio Senator John Glenn, whose Government Operations Committee reviews the cleanup effort, says the amount of money budgeted should have been more than double.
What got us into this mess is that the Russians are coming. Got to produce. Where are you going to put the waste? Well, put in that pit out there. We'll worry about it later. And we're too many pits later. Now we have to start cleaning up.
Glenn says without more money in the budget, little will get done in 1990 except planning for future cleanup activities. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards on Capitol Hill.
The Supreme Court agreed today to rule on a Missouri law regulating abortions, a case that could have a bearing nationwide on a woman's right to choose abortion. Among other things, the Missouri law in question bans public hospitals from performing abortions unless necessary to save a woman's life. It also declares that human life begins at conception. The law was ruled unconstitutional by a federal appeals court. Lawyers for the state hope to reverse that decision, and the Justice Department hopes the High Court will also take the opportunity to reverse its 1973 decision in Roe versus Wade that legalized abortions. The government today unveiled draft regulations aimed at protecting an estimated 5.3 million health care workers against AIDS and other blood-borne diseases. The measures would cost employers some $850 million a year. U.S. and Japanese banks may agree to pay part of the Philippines' $28 billion in foreign debts in exchange for Manila allowing U.S. bases to remain. The Philippine ambassador today said he has received feelers on the debt for bases deal from Japanese and American financiers. A federal judge issued a temporary restraining order today blocking a three-week-old immigration service rule. Opponents say the INS rule has left hundreds of Central Americans living in tents and shanties on the lower Rio Grande Valley. Americans took out $4.5 billion more in consumer debt than they paid off in November. On Wall Street, stocks closed higher. The Dow Industrial Average rose more than 5 points. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Singer Hoagy Carmichael is probably best known for the songs he wrote or co-wrote, such as Georgia on My Mind, Stardust, Heart and Soul, and Up a Lazy River, and for his appearances in movies, including To Have and Have Not, The Best Years of Our Lives, and Young Man with a Horn. Beginning in the 20s, he recorded with jazz musicians, but in the LP era, he was heard mostly in front of studio orchestras. Jazz critic Evan Whitehead has a review of a new reissue from the 50s, featuring Carmichael with a jazz band that Kevin says gave the singer a new lift.
Skylark, have you anything to say to me? Won't you tell me where my love can be? Is there a meadow in the mist where someone's waiting to be kissed? Skylark.
Hoagy Carmichael became a jazz fan as soon as there were jazz records to hear, around 1917, when he was in his own teens. Not long after that, he began writing songs. In 1924, his friend and idol, the cornet virtuoso Bix Beiderbecke, recorded Carmichael's Riverboat Shuffle, which was itself influenced by Beiderbecke's sweet and sentimental improvising. Carmichael was one of the first pop writers to get the feel of jazz into his scores, but his pieces also reflect the hominess and easygoing melodicism of turn-of-the-century parlor music. Carmichael wasn't just a great songwriter. He was also a fine interpreter. On the 1956 album, Hoagy Sings Carmichael, just reissued as a budget CD by Pacific Jazz, he sings 10 of his own songs, arranged for large band by Johnny Mandel. The players include Harry Sweets Edison on trumpet, Art Pepper on alto sax, and Jimmy Rolls on piano and celeste. Here's Hoagy Carmichael singing his 1929 classic, Rockin' Chair.
Old rockin' chair's got me keen by my side. Fetch me that ginseng before I tan your hide. I can't get from this cabin I ain't going nowhere, ain't going nowhere. Just set me here grabbing, grabbing at the flies round this rocking chair. My dear old Addie Head. How long in heaven she be? Send me sweet chariot for the end of the troubles I see.
Bix Beiderbecke was Carmichael's inspiration as a songwriter. But as a singer, his apparent model on this date was another old associate, the Texas trombonist Jack Teagarden. Teagarden's lazy drawl was flavored by cowboy music as much as jazz, and Rockin' Chair had been his feature when he toured with Louis Armstrong. Hoagy Carmichael excelled at writing mood pieces about a bygone America idealized almost to the point of satire. One of the best is Memphis in June, written with lyricist Paul Francis Webster.
Memphis in June, a shady veranda under a Sunday blue sky. Memphis in June and cousin Amanda's making a rhubarb pie. I can hear the clock inside a ticking and a talking. Everything is peacefully dandy. I can see old Granny cross the street, still a rocking, watching the neighbors go by. Memphis in June, and sweet oleander blowing perfume in the air. Up jumps a moon to make it that much grander. It's paradise, brother, take my advice. Nothing's half as nice as Memphis in June.
I love the way that alto flute harks back to Carmichael's whistling at the start of the tune. Johnny Mandel's arrangements are filled with nice details like that. He sneaks a quote from Reveille into the song Two Sleepy People. The musicians who backed Hoagy Carmichael on record didn't always do him justice, but the jazzmen on this session knew his worth, which is the main reason Hoagy Sings Carmichael may be the best album he ever made.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Hoagy Sings Carmichael on the Pacific Jazz label.
Well, here we are, just about the same foggy little fella, drowsy little dame, two sleepy people by dawn's early light, and too much in love to say good night.
This is Fresh Air. More than 30 years ago, the Philadelphia police took an unusual step in their attempt to uncover the identity of a dead child found in the woods. They dressed the corpse up in pants and a shirt, posed the body on a chair, and then photographed him. That photograph found a permanent place in the memory of writer Seymour Shubin. It's the basis for Shubin's new mystery novel, Never Quite Dead. This is the opening passage, read by Seymour Shubin.
He opened the door from the kitchen to the basement and looked down at the darkness before turning on the light. Walking down, he had the feeling of uneasiness he had had as a kid when he used to come down here, sometimes with his friends, to take the dead little boy's pictures out of his father's files and stare at them one by one with a mixture of fascination and horror. The poor little boy, as he used to think of him. The boy of three or four with the bruises on his head someone had dumped on a vacant lot, and no one had ever come forward to identify. No mother or father, no aunt or uncle or cousin or neighbor or someone who might have just gotten a quick glimpse of him, like a door-to-door salesman or a repairman. Someone.
There's a true story that lies behind the novel, and you had seen pictures of a dead boy who was dressed up by the police so he'd look more real?
Yes, so he would look lifelike. At that time, I was a writer for a True Detective Story magazine. Now, this little boy was found in a cardboard box in a wooded section of Philadelphia. And he was nude, but he was covered with a blanket, and there were bruises on his body. The police thought he would be easy to identify, and, of course, relatively easy to arrest whoever killed him. But his identity has not been known, is not known to this very day. And so this case has always, always gripped me, and you can say haunted me.
You had tried to write the story of this boy in fictional form, to imagine his story before, but it never quite worked until you wrote this book. What didn't work about the previous directions that you took?
I tried to write it as a straight thriller, and that is, first I took my own thinking, why wouldn't anybody come forward and identify this boy? So I thought, well, as far as the story goes, it could be that he was the son of a spy and the spies couldn't come forward, or it could be the president's illegitimate child, or there was some laboratory where some scientist was using children as experiments. And I would go so far with it, and then it would stop dead. It just didn't work. Now, it only started to work when I started to think of the boy in real terms, and I started to put into practice what I really believe about thrillers. You do not have to take the very high-tech and the very esoteric and make suspenseful stories out of them. You can take what could be the ordinary things of life. And this is suddenly I saw that this was somebody's child, and somebody killed him, and for some reason, nobody wants to name him.
You had a bestseller in 1953, Anyone's My Name. Your next novel came out in 1958, Manta. Then your next novel, Wellsville, in 1961. Your next book after that was 21 years later, in 1982, The Captain. What happened during those 21 years?
Well, I didn't exactly run away to Europe. I worked as a freelancer. I did a lot of medical articles. First of all, the first was a bestseller. The second two, you can call them worse sellers. They were not suspense. They were ordinary sellers. And I had a family to raise. I also went to work as a managing editor of a psychiatric journal. Meanwhile, it's very strange that I always knew that I was going to come back to the novel.
But you felt you couldn't make a living and support your family on writing novels.
No. And also, I was looking for the novel that would really do it. In other words, I was looking for the perfect, for the sure plot, which, of course, is a sure way not to write.
Right, because no plot will ever measure up,
so you just don't
write.
So I said, let me just write a novel and let it just come. So I wrote a first draft without reading back on it. And I saw that the things that held me back, well, like a preposition at the end of the sentence, believe it or not, it still would hang me up, let it go. And I sort of, it sounds very pretentious, but I found a voice for myself.
You've written, in your own words, bushels of stories for True Detective magazine. When was that in your career that you were writing for them?
This was in 1945 for about 15 years.
That's a long time.
Yes, but that wasn't all I did. In the middle, I wrote articles for the Saturday Post and Reader's Digest, and I also wrote my first novel, Anyone's My Name, which is really the story of a true detective story writer. I drew directly on my experiences, although I embellished it. It's not an autobiography, but the feelings are very much autobiographical.
What's the idea behind the true detective stories, that people want to read about crime, but if it's real, it's more interesting?
Yes, now it may have changed since I've done it, but the point they were interested then, they were interested in the crime and they were interested in the pictures and the detective work. For instance, if a crime was solved by someone, a witness saw a license plate pulling away from the house, I mean, that's really not much of a detection. But you were allowed in those days to put down a button was found at the scene, and somehow that tied in with something else and something else. Now, that does not go today, from what I understand.
You mean making up that
making
a button
up,
was found?
Yes, yes. So I was able to use my fictional abilities, and this bothered me a great, great deal. And if anyone can find Anyone's My Name, they'll see where my guilts came out. It came out in a murder that my surrogate commits. In other words, he finds himself in the same position as a killer, of these killers that he wrote so glibly about as a true detective story writer. So that did bother me. I used it as a means to an end.
Did it help you find a voice for writing?
I seem to have... It's very hard to say, because when I applied for this job, I knew nothing about true detective story writing. He gave me a manuscript to rewrite, and I just rewrote it, and he said, you have the job. So there was something about it that I knew how to do.
Mm-hmm.
In fact... My first novel was, I was very surprised when it was called a thriller, because as far as I knew, it was just a story of a man who commits a murder. And for the next two books, I deliberately stayed away from suspense. And that's another thing that may have held me back during these 20 years. I looked down as a writer on the very thing I turned out to be pretty good at. It wasn't literature with a capital L, I thought. But then along the way, I found everything I do is filled with suspense. If I go to the newspaper store, and I want a New York Times. Sometimes I find myself heart beating a little fast. Will the Times be in? Will it be sold out? driving in today, will the snow, will someone ram in? And suspense just fills my life anyway. Some people might call it anxiety. All right, I call it...
you write stress novels.
Right. I call it suspense.
The character in the main character in your new novel is a writer also, and he writes mystery novels, and it's a series of novels with a detective named Cade, and I was wondering why you never took that direction yourself of having a series.
I want to write something relatively new each time, so I find if I have a series and if I have a character, you know, I want to think more than rather go to the same character. I'd rather think of something new. My preference in suspense is writing about people who somehow, almost against their knowing it, take on the role of detectives. But they are not officially detectives. They just run across this in the course of their life. This is something that happens to them. And I find that more interesting to me.
When your imagination runs free about crime, do you see yourself as the potential criminal or the potential victim?
A little bit of both, a little bit of both. But again, I have to stand back from it.
In order to tell a story.
In order to tell the story. And part of this book, I don't know if you got it out of it, but only about half of it is a traditional mystery. And then it changes into something else. What I could consider maybe psychological suspense, and which is sort of a risk for me to have taken. But I'm interested in the whys and hows rather than who done it, is why done it, and will he done it again?
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Seymour Shubin's new novel, Never Quite Dead, is published by St. Martin's Press. This is Fresh Air. Alex Chadwick is joining us from Washington, D.C. to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. What story are you following, Alex?
Terry, the big story today is the budget, the federal budget. President Reagan is sending his proposed budget for this next year up to Capitol Hill today. We'll review what's in the budget, what the president is calling for, a budget of more than $1 trillion for the federal government to spend. We'll talk about the kinds of assumptions that go into making the budget. That is, what does this budget say about how the country is going to do in the next year? We'll have a report on the defense budget, and we'll have reaction from Capitol Hill to what the president is proposing. We're also covering a case before the Supreme Court today that could either narrow or overturn the famous Roe v. Wade abortion ruling.
Thanks, Alex. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Television critic David Bianculli says there's a sleeper among this season's TV series. He says Tattinger's is coming into its own, but it might be up against new obstacles.
Question. What sounds like George Gershwin looks like Woody Allen and is just about to disappear? The answer is the opening credits of Tattinger's, the new NBC series about a Good Samaritan type who runs a New York restaurant. The Gershwin-esque music is written by Jonathan Tunick, who's orchestrated several Stephen Sondheim scores. The black and white photos of New York look very much like the moody photography of Woody Allen's Manhattan. And together, the music and the images strongly suggest that Tattinger's will be really special. Unfortunately, the opening episode of Tattinger's, broadcast back in October, didn't deliver on that promise. Even though the show comes from the makers of St. Elsewhere, the viewers of the first two shows weren't impressed, and they went elsewhere. As a result, Tattinger's will go on hiatus after this week's episode. When it returns, it has 2 one-hour episodes left to show, and then NBC and the show's producers have agreed to retool it in a half-hour format. NBC is making that decision because it's looking at the ratings. I'm frustrated by that decision because I've been looking at the show, and it's gotten a lot better. Tattinger's has been hurt by the writer's strike and didn't really find itself until the 4th or 5th episode. By then, a lot of folks had switched over to Wise Guy, the competition on CBS. And I understand why. On Wise Guy, drama is when a slime ball breaks the hero's leg with a baseball bat. On Tattinger's, drama is when the marble on the pastry table isn't chilled enough. Anyone who returns to Tattinger's for a second helping, so to speak, will be pleasantly surprised. The scripts are fleshing out the characters and relationships, and the stars, Stephen Collins, Blythe Danner, Jerry Stiller, and especially Mary Beth Hurt, are rising to the challenge. Like St. Elsewhere, Tattinger's thrives on surprises. Already this season, one of the most likable employees of the restaurant has been fired, and the hero of one story has been the heavy in another. In the last few weeks, the episodes have had a wide emotional range, going from slapstick to serious drama. One scene, in which heavy crates of liquor were slid from street level to the restaurant basement, looked like it was choreographed by Charlie Chaplin. Another scene, in which a woman begged her mother to finally talk about her years in a Nazi concentration camp, wasn't funny at all.
Tell me something that only you know. Tell me.
We fashioned our uniforms to look like the SS. Does that help you? We wore jack boots. We relied on our tormentors, no matter how barbaric. I served in bordels, in 9 camps. That was the easiest work they gave.
It's not true, Mama, that is not true. You're strong, you're brave.
Finally, there are the jokes, which have begun to crop up just as they did on St. Elsewhere. How can you not love a place that has a customer die in Mr. Wilkes' booth? Or one that has my line on the menu, just so Kitty Carlisle Hart can ask Arlene Francis, what's my line? In short, Tattinger's has evolved into a 4-star restaurant. Let's just hope that by turning it into a 30-minute show, NBC doesn't turn it into a fast food TV joint.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time we meet singer Irma Thomas. She had a string of New Orleans R&B hits in the 60s. Now she's recording again. Also, rock historian Ed Ward looks at the Motown songwriting team of Holland, Dozier, and Holland. And book critic John Leonard reviews Lost in Translation, a memoir by Polish emigre and New York intellectual Eva Hoffman. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's show was produced by Mark Vogelzang, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Research assistance from Tim Jacoby. Our engineer is Orji Voblidis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.